Overarching subject in all of this is God's joy at the recovery of the lost. And he's, as I said, he's offering these stories in direct response to some criticism that he received. And so he was addressing a specific audience and teaching a specific lesson. And this morning I want to look at the setting and the first two of the parables, and then at a later date look at the third one on the prodigal son. But even so, by the end of the day yesterday, I was beginning to feel somewhat overwhelmed and like maybe I bit off more than I could chew. So I'm going to share what I have, what I've put together. There's a lot more that's here than I didn't touch on, and maybe some of it I allude to and don't dive into as much as I should. But bear with me, and we'll go through what I have here, and hopefully can gain some inspiration and some challenges as we look at what Jesus had to say here. There's a lot of cultural undertones in these stories that maybe we miss when we just read through them quickly, and so we want to try to touch on some of those as well. I've titled the message, Lost, Found, and Celebrated. Lost, Found, and Celebrated. And I want to read the first three verses to get started here. Luke 15, verse 1, then drew near unto him all the publicans and sinners for to hear him. And the Pharisees and scribes murmured, saying, this man receiveth sinners and eateth with them. And he spake this parable unto them, saying. If we were to back up to Luke chapter 9 and verse 51, I believe it is, Jesus begins his return to Jerusalem for his final trip to Jerusalem. He set his face to go unto Jerusalem. And then the next chapters, including chapter 15 here, are teaching and stories as he's making his way back to Jerusalem for what he knows is going to be his death, his ultimate sacrifice. The rest of the people have not grasped that yet, but that is where Jesus is going. That is what he is working towards. And he's having these different conversations. He's stopping in various communities. He's surrounded by these mobs of people, and he's teaching them specific lessons. And at least twice in the previous chapters, as he's going, it's recorded that he was invited to and accepted invitations to Pharisees' houses. And in chapter 14, verse 1, it specifically says, and it came to pass as he went into the house of one of the chief Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath day that they watched him. And then we get to chapter 15 here, and it starts out saying that all these publicans and sinners were drawing near to him, and the Pharisees and scribes were not happy. So apparently he wasn't just stopping at the Pharisees' houses for lunch. Apparently he was having lunch with anybody and everybody. And so we see three parties. We see the publicans and sinners. We see the religious, which was the Pharisees and scribes, and we see Jesus. The religious, the Pharisees and scribes, this is a term that we encounter quite frequently in the New Testament. Sometimes it says Pharisees and scribes, sometimes scribes and Pharisees. But who were these people? And this morning in our Sunday school lesson, we looked at Saul, who, in his own words, was a Pharisee of the Pharisees. So what were Pharisees? Pharisees were a religious and political group within the Jews that were known for their strict observance of the law, and not just the law of Moses, but the oral traditions that had been passed down from generation to generation and added to, and which were later compiled into what was called the Mishnah. But they were all of the additional laws that were added to the law of Moses over the years. Usually they were middle, upper class people, oftentimes lay people, sometimes they were rabbis. And one wasn't born a Pharisee. You probably knew this, but this was a new thought to me. I guess I just hadn't stopped to think about it. But no, they were not born a Pharisee. Just because your dad was a Pharisee did not mean that you were a Pharisee. To become a Pharisee, they had to go through an intensive training program, sit at the feet of another Pharisee, like Saul sat at the feet of Gamaliel. It was an intensive training program. They made certain vows of things that they weren't going to do. It required a strict observance of all the law. And only men could be Pharisees. Only men could be Pharisees. Scribes then were those that were experts in studying, preserving, and teaching the law. That's what they did. They studied the law, they preserved the law, they taught the law. And many of the scribes were Pharisees, but not all of them were. You didn't have to be a Pharisee to be a scribe, or you didn't have to be a scribe to be a Pharisee. But a lot of the scribes were Pharisees as well. But these two groups of people were the self-appointed judges of everybody. They were the authority on the law. They were the ones that made sure everybody else, or tried to make sure that everybody else was in line, was keeping the law. The second group was the publicans and sinners. These people were drawn to Jesus and to his teachings. And they were called sinners by the Pharisees and scribes because they were the ceremonially unclean. They were the ones that didn't keep the letter of the law. They didn't follow all of the law. They were the lawbreakers. The publicans were the tax collectors. And they were classified with sinners because not only did they not keep the law, but they colluded with the enemy. They hobnobbed with the Romans, the oppressors. And so they were doubly hated, not just because they were sinners, but also because they were publicans. The Roman system in that day was they levied a tax on the oppressed people, but to collect the tax, they would essentially sell the route to the highest bidder, if you can use that term. In other words, they would say, okay, for this region, we need somebody to collect taxes. Whoever's the highest bidder can be the tax collector for that area. And sometimes it was Gentiles, other times it was unscrupulous Jews that would be the high bidder. And so therefore, then they were the tax collector for that area. And the Romans said, here's the tax rate. It's 12% tax. That's what we want. But you as tax collector, you can charge whatever you want. As long as we get our 12%, we're happy. You can set the rate whatever you want to. And so the tax collectors did just that. The publicans would make the rate whatever they wanted to. And we know from the story of Zacchaeus, he talks about taking four times what was necessary, or he was going to restore fourfold, implying that he had taken considerably more than what was needed. And so the other reason they were hated, another reason they were hated is because they were greedy and unscrupulous. They would take whatever they wanted to do from you. And so they were enriching themselves at the expense of the other people, as well as working for the Romans. And so they were hated, and so they were lumped here with the sinners, the publicans and sinners. And then, of course, the third group here, the third person, is Jesus. And every word and action of Jesus was deliberate. And the people here had a twofold accusation of Jesus. It said they receive sinners. He receives sinners and he eats with them. And this word receiveth, when we think of to receive something, you accept it, you take it. You receive visitors at your house, you welcome them into your house. And that is the Greek word dekoma. Simply means to accept or welcome. But the word that's translated receiveth here is prostekoma. There's a prefix added to it, which implies a much closer connection. It's not just accepting, it's accepting as a brother. It's welcoming as a brother. And so you might welcome, strangers might come to your house, and you may welcome them by opening the door and conversing with them, but you don't truly receive them as Jesus was receiving. Jesus would open the door and invite them in and serve them a meal. That's the difference between the two words. That's what's implied here. He receiveth sinners. He's accepting them with open arms. And it's... The word is used, this prosdekoma word is used a few times in the New Testament. One of the other places where it's used, Paul uses it a couple times. In Romans 16:2, he used it when he's talking about Phoebe, and he says, receive her in the Lord as becometh saints. And so accept her as a sister in the Lord. And so that's what Jesus was doing. He was welcoming these people as brothers and sisters. And so the first complaint is that Jesus was receiving and treating these sinners as valuable humans and friends, rather than avoiding them, as the Pharisees thought he should be doing, or as the Pharisees did. And then the second complaint was that he eats with them. Not only did he not avoid them, he sat down and shared a meal with them. And a staunch religious person, Pharisee and scribe, would not risk defilement by mingling with sinners. The food was probably unclean, and by sitting down, then therefore they became unclean by mingling with them. And to understand why they disliked this so much, we have to understand the culture a little bit. To eat in this Eastern culture, to eat with a person signified acceptance of that person and imparted a blessing on them. And I quote from the writings of Joachim Jeremias, who was a scholar that studied Middle Eastern culture in relation to the New Testament. And he wrote, "To understand what Jesus was doing in eating with sinners, it is important to realize that in the East, even today, to invite a man to a meal was an honor. It was an offer of peace, trust, brotherhood, and forgiveness. In short, sharing a table meant sharing life. Thus, Jesus' meals with the publicans and sinners are an expression of the mission and message of Jesus. It is the most meaningful expression of the message of the redeeming love of God." And so these Pharisees and scribes understood that to eat with somebody implied acceptance. It implied that they were accepting them where they were, and that was a problem with them. They were not murmuring because they were concerned that Jesus was going to be defiled. They didn't care about that. No, their murmuring was because they understood the significance of his acts, and they understood that by Jesus doing this, he was going against all of their self-righteousness and all of their constructed social structures. It threatened the law that they so zealously protected. And so they didn't care about Jesus. They didn't care about sinners. They cared about somebody actually acknowledging the sinners as valuable humans. And this word murmur here, it says they murmured, is used one other place in the New Testament, also in relation to the Pharisees and scribes, in Luke 19:7, when Jesus again was hobnobbing with the publicans when he went home with Zacchaeus. They said, when they saw it, they all murmured, saying that he was gone to be guest with a man that is a sinner. Again, the same problem. He's going to the house and sitting down with somebody that's a sinner. And so Jesus gave these three parables as a defense of his actions to explain why he was doing what he was doing. And these three parties appear in each one. We have the Pharisees, the sinners, and Jesus in each parable. And in all three, there's something that's lost, there's something that's found, and there's joyful celebration. A couple of other interesting notes on these three before we look at the first two specifically. In the first one, the object that's lost is an animal. In the second one, the object is an inanimate object. And in the third, it's a person. And we'll touch on that a little bit more as we go along. Another progression. In the first one, the loss is 1 in 100. In the second, it's 1 in 10. And in the third, it's 1 in 2. And the third progression is, in the first, it was lost in the wilderness. The second, it was lost in the house. And the third, it was lost outside of the Father's love. And again, all of those figure in here are important. So, reading now, starting at verse 3, reading this first parable. "And he spake this parable unto them, saying, What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he lose one of them, doth not leave the 99 in the wilderness, and go after that which is lost, until he find it? And when he hath found it, he layeth it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he cometh home, he calleth together his friends and neighbors, saying unto them, Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost. I say unto you that likewise joy shall be in heaven over one sinner that repenteth, more than over 99 just persons which need no repentance." And so at first glance, simple reading, it seems to be a very simple tale. One that they could easily connect with. A shepherd, he's responsible for 100 sheep. One of them wanders off and he fails to see, and so he's responsible. I've only got 99 sheep. I'm missing one. I'm responsible. I go find a sheep. He frantically searches till he finds it, and when he finds it, he's happy. He's rejoicing. He carries it home, and there's celebration because I have 100 sheep again. But of course, we know there is much more to the story. And I enjoy... literary styles. See if this will pop here. I enjoy literary styles of the Hebrew and Greek writing. And so just for interest's sake, we're not going to dwell on this a lot. Central theme of these parables is joy and restoration. And if you notice, it's in the center here. And if you follow the parable through, you have you, he says, which one of you? We have one, we have 99, we have lost, find, and then there's rejoicing, and it's restored, and there's rejoicing, because we found what was lost, and then the same U199 when he gives the interpretation. and that on some form of that structure is used in all three of these. The central theme being highlighted in the structure of the story. And it's intriguing to me that in the translation, these structures were maintained in the way in when they translated it from the Greek. And I find that very intriguing, and not everybody does, and so bear with me. But we're not going to talk about that a whole lot more besides interest's sake as we think about the structure of this parable. And so joy and restoration is the key theme of these parables. But in this first one, we see four themes. Number one, we have the shepherd who lost his sheep. In the Old Testament, which of course the Pharisees and scribes were very, very versed in, they had studied this. To be a Pharisee, they had to study the Old Testament, the law and the prophets. They knew these things. They were well aware of God being likened to a shepherd, specifically Psalm 23. They knew Psalm 23. They understood that God was a shepherd. And throughout the prophets, Jesus, or God, and the leaders of Israel are referred to as shepherds, responsible for the sheep of the people. And so this analogy was not lost on them. But by this time frame, the shepherds were considered little better than sinners to the Pharisees and scribes. They abhorred the sinners. And in fact, in the Mishnah, it states that it was impossible for a person to be a shepherd and still keep the law. That was their view of the scribes and Pharisees' view of shepherds. And so they were little better than sinners. But Jesus says, which one of you, making them imagine they were a shepherd. So these righteous people who kept the law religiously, he's saying, now consider you're a shepherd. You're keepers of the people, so you're responsible for the flock. You have 100. By implication, all the sheep are under your care, but you lost one. And notice he says, if he lose one of them, this wording structure was not the normal structure that the way the Greek people talked. And it's still today, even in like Spanish and so forth, they talk in reverse structure. And those of you know Spanish understand that. The sheep was lost, you would say, in some other languages. And that's the way that they would have said it here in their language as well. The sheep was lost. It wasn't, you didn't lose the sheep, because if you notice, when he calls his friends and neighbors together, he says, I found the sheep which was lost, not the sheep that I lost. But Jesus says, you lost the sheep, implying that they were careless. And instead of attempting to find the lost sheep, you're murmuring about the one who is seeking it. He's saying by implication. So the second theme then we have is the good shepherd who goes after the sheep. Jesus is using the illustration here of personal wealth. 100 sheep represented significant wealth in those days. But 1% of this wealth was still very much worth finding. One sheep out of 99, that was 1%. Still worth finding, putting forth the effort. And a good shepherd would put forth the necessary effort to find it. And it wasn't easy to find. It wasn't nice, smooth, lush pastures that they kept mowed and well fertilized. This was hilly, scrubby territory. This was uphill and downhill. They had to maybe search ravines and little inlets and backtracking, retracing steps, go down, check this little nook and go out. And it was a lot of work to find a sheep. And then what about the 99 that it says were left in the wilderness? And again, this is one of the things that he kind of leaves dangling in this parable, and we'll tie it up when we get to the end in the next sermon when we look at the prodigal son. But he says the 99, he leaves them in the wilderness. Those that study this history would tell us that normally when there was a flock of 100 sheep, there was more than one shepherd. you had a main shepherd and he probably had some boys or somebody that helped him to look after the flock, because it was hard for one man to look after 100 sheep by himself. And so they would tell us that likely there was a couple of underlings, one or more underlings, and so the shepherd would help them get the sheep into kind of a protected area and leave them in the care of the underlings, and then he would go and search for the sheep. He would look for this lost sheep. And then the third theme that we have is the price that's paid by the shepherd to rescue the lost sheep. Sheep don't wander back home again by themselves. Sheep are not that kind of a creature. In fact, they're completely unable to find their way home. A dog, you know, there's stories of dogs that find their way home from miles away, and cats and other animals that find their way home. Sheep aren't that way. Sheep, when they wander off, they wander off. They don't return home at the end of the day. And so if you want your sheep back, you had to go find it, and you had to pay the price to do it. And finding the lost sheep was actually the easy part, because once he found the sheep, he couldn't put a leash on it and lead it home, or he couldn't chase it in front of him and expect it to go. No, he had to pick up the sheep and put it on his shoulders and carry it home over the rocks and the crevices. And I found a picture here of an illustration. You can see the landscape, not very pleasant landscape, hills and rocks, and the sheep on his shoulder. And it's not just a little lamb. Oftentimes in coloring books and Bible story books, you see pictures of Jesus with a cute little lamb around his shoulders. Well, probably it's not the cute little lamb that wandered off. It's probably the big old ewe that weighs 100 pounds. And that's the one that he had to go find and put on his shoulders and carry it home. After he had walked for who knows how long and climbed up and down the hills, then he has to climb back down the hill with this sheep on his shoulder. And so there was a significant price to pay to restore the sheep. But what does he do when he finds it? He lays it on his shoulder rejoicing. So there's joy in finding. There's joy in finding the lost sheep. And that's before he's even got it back where it needs to be. He knows there's a long trek ahead of him. He knows there's hard work ahead of him. But he's still rejoicing. And then the fourth theme is this communal rejoicing when the sheep is brought home. And you have to remember that, again, in this time frame, they lived in these little villages. And everybody knew everybody. And everybody was friends with everybody. And everybody knew what everybody else was doing. There wasn't many secrets. And so if you didn't bring your flock of sheep back in the evening, they knew that there was a problem. So everybody knew that Shepherd John was still looking for a lost sheep. So everybody knew there was a lost sheep. And they were watching. As people that depended on the sheep for their livelihood, they understood this, the importance of that sheep. And so they were watching at their doorsteps for when he would return with this sheep. And when he comes into earshot, he calls to them, "I found my sheep. I found my sheep." He's rejoicing. And they gather around him and they rejoice with him. And they celebrate. They have a celebration of joy that this one sheep has been found, this 1%. And I think we clearly understand the symbolism that Jesus was sharing here. The sheep was the audience and, by extension, all mankind. The lost sheep was the repentant sinner. And the good shepherd is Jesus. He said, "For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." He is the one that went to all the work, all the pain and suffering to find the lost sheep. And who are the 99 just that need no repentance? Well, they're still in the wilderness, apparently. They're the self-righteous. They're the ones that don't think they need anything. And so Jesus responds to these murmuring Pharisees. He says, "I eat with the sinners because I'm the good shepherd. I came to round up lost sheep and bring them home. And if just one of those sinners that I eat with returns to God, there's more rejoicing with God than over all the 99 self-righteous people that don't want to eat with me because I'm eating with the sinners." And Jesus is presenting a radical new idea about repentance here. The Pharisees, remember who his audience is. His audience is the keepers of the law, the religious elite. And in order to be righteous, you had to keep the law. all of the law. It was all about works. It was all about doing the right things and avoiding the sinners. But Jesus says, repentance is not a work that we can do on our own. Just like the lost sheep can't rescue itself, it needs to be found. It needs to be carried out. So being rescued is a gift. And repentance is the acceptance of the gift of being found. He says, you can sit in the shade of the temple and still be lost. Or you can answer my call and accept my gift of being found, and I will bring you home to God. And then he gives another parable. Or he continues with another variation. Starting in verse 8. Either what woman, having 10 pieces of silver, if she lose one piece, doth not light a candle and sweep the house and seek diligently till she find it? And when she hath found it, she calleth her friends and her neighbors together, saying, rejoice with me, for I have found the piece which I had lost. Likewise I say unto you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner that repenteth. A very similar story, parable, with some significant variations. Again, we have the three categories. We have the Pharisees and the sinner and sinner and Jesus, and we have the lost and the found and the celebration. But probably the first and most obvious difference is that the main character of this story is a woman. And so Jesus is talking to the Pharisees, and he starts off saying, now imagine you're a shepherd, which they hated. And then he says, he doesn't say, now imagine you're a woman, but he gives the story as of a woman. And a woman was almost equal to a sinner in the Pharisees' eyes. Remember, women were very second rate in that culture. They couldn't even be taught the law. They didn't go to school. They didn't learn the law. A woman was a second rate citizen. But Jesus is using a woman as the main character of this story. And so in the first parable, Jesus says, I am the good shepherd. In the second parable, he says, I am the good woman. And maybe one of the reasons he gave this parable was, again, to poke their sense of righteousness. First of all, a shepherd is okay. A woman is okay. In my kingdom, we're all equal. Maybe that was one of the reasons why. Another important difference, and we already alluded to this or mentioned this earlier, was that this loss was at home, in the house. And the significance of this will become more clear when we look at the third parable. And so I'm going to let that for now. But she had 10 coins. This lady had 10 coins. It was her life savings. The ladies were the ones that went to market. The ladies were the ones that did the shopping. Now that culture hasn't changed a whole lot. The ladies did the shopping, and they had the coins. And of course, a lot of it was barter, but they still had some coins to buy some supplies. And those 10 coins represented the wealth that she had to provide for her family, the needs of her families for whatever the time frame was, whether it was the next month or the next 3 months, we don't know. But that was the wealth that she had. And she probably carried it in a knotted rag around her neck, which, again, if you've been to third world countries, they still do that. You go to market in Guatemala or something like that, and they don't use usually rags anymore, although I've seen some with rags, but oftentimes they use more of a money purse, a little money bag that they have on a string around their neck, and it's a safe, secure place to put it, and they'll pull it out and they get out their money. Probably something like that. She had these 10 coins knotted in a rag, tied around her neck. It was a safe, secure place to keep them, but she lost one. And it doesn't tell us how she lost it. Was she, had her husband brought home his wages at the end of the day, and she was adding them to her bag and one dropped out? Was she busy about the house and one fell out? We don't know, but she lost one. She discovered one was missing. Did she hear it fall? Whatever the case. That was 10% of her wealth. And so in the first parable, we have 1% of the wealth. Now we're upping it and it's 10% of her wealth. 10% of her wealth was missing. She needed every coin to buy enough provisions. She needed that. And she couldn't blame anyone else. There was nobody else to blame. The sheep might wander off and the shepherd not see it. And so the argument could be made that, well, the sheep wandered off. It's not really the shepherd's fault. In this case, she couldn't blame anybody else. She was the only one there. She was responsible. She takes full responsibility for this loss. And so she puts forth the effort. It says She lights the candle. She sweeps the house. She seeks diligently till she finds it. She couldn't turn on the 100-watt light bulb or get out the flashlight or whatever it was. And to also be able to understand this a little better, I found a little illustration some wording about their houses from a Father Corbo, who was an Italian priest and an archaeologist that did a lot of excavation in the Holy Lands in the 1960s. And he says that in that region, there were a lot of black rock that they used to build their houses. And if they had, of the houses that they've excavated, not all of them had windows. And if they had a window, it was just a little slit up towards the top of the wall. And he says that the floors, and I quote here, with irregular, roundish stones of black basalt with deep interstices or cracks, makes it possible to understand real well the context of the gospel parable. And so they would lay down these black rock to make their floor, but there was cracks in between, and it was easy for things to fall down in. And so she gets the candle, and the picture you get is she sweeps the floor, and she doesn't find it, and so she takes her candle and with her broom, and she investigates every crack, trying to find this lost coin. And this was, a story that they were familiar with. They understood, because as he was excavating, he said different times in their excavations, they would actually find coins in the cracks on the floor. So this was something that happened. This was an everyday occurrence, maybe not every day, but it was an occurrence that they were familiar with. And the parable gives more detail about what she did to find the lost coin. And so the cost of the search is portrayed as higher. The value of the thing lost is greater as a percentage. The cost of the search is higher. But in this parable, there is no cost of restoration. Once the coin is found, it's automatically restored. She has it. She found it. She has it. Another interesting aspect of this story is that there's more self-revelation in it as well. Her friends and neighbors would likely not have known that she lost the coin if she wouldn't have told them. She was in her house. She was working. When she realized it was missing, she looked for it and she found it. And she could have went about her day and nobody else would have known about it. But she was so happy in finding this that she couldn't help but share it. And so she calls her friends and neighbors. And the words translated friends and neighbors here are the feminine form of the words that are used in verse 6. And so in verse 6, it's the masculine form of the words. In verse 9, it's the feminine. So she calls all of the town women, her friends, her peers, and she calls them together and she says, I lost this coin and I found it. And they all rejoice with her because they understood the value of that coin because they lived the same life she did. And they understood the importance of that coin and the rejoicing in finding that one coin. And so they rejoice with her. And so the lost was found and there's rejoicing. So we have joy, restoration, and joy. And Jesus again concludes with very similar, where he says, I say unto you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner that repenteth, the value of the sinner. And so he's upping the value of the thing lost. The Pharisees and scribes had nothing to do with the lost, with the sinners. And they were murmuring at Jesus for hobnobbing with the sinners. And so Jesus starts with a parable where 1% of the wealth is lost. And it's valuable, that 1% is valuable enough for that shepherd to go to all that work to find that lost sheep and carry it home, and everybody rejoices. But if that's not enough, he tells another story and he says, 10% of her wealth was lost. And it was worth looking for, of course, because now it's more valuable. And the rejoicing. And of course, we know that the third one, which we're not going to talk about, is the son. One out of two in the value. And so Jesus is instilling in their mind the value of the thing that's lost. The Pharisees could understand searching for a lost coin, because that was the life they lived. They could understand searching for a lost sheep because they understood the importance of that sheep. And they could understand the celebration. But they refused to acknowledge the value of the sinners and chose rather to murmur and speak against Jesus. And so, in summary, Jesus is the good shepherd Jesus is the good woman. He doesn't mind at all being compared to either one. It's Jesus who seeks the lost sinner over the rocks and through the ravines and in the dust and the dirt. It's God who initiates the search for the sinner because the sinner belongs to him. It was his possession that was lost. And because on his own, the sinner is helpless and lifeless. It's God who reaches down in love and compassion and grace and mercy to restore the sinner. And it's God who breaks forth in joyous celebration, the overflowing rejoicing at the restoration of the lost. And so these two parables provide the springboard for the third and most important lesson that he was teaching them, which is the climax of these three. And it would probably be valuable to look at this the same day as we do the other two, but I'm not going to keep you any longer, and we'll look at that, the third parable, the next time, and tie together, hopefully, Lord willing, some of these threads that he's weaving through here and apply them to our lives today. Let's pray.